This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We start today again in Provincetown, where cases linked to a 4th of July COVID cluster continue to grow. The latest data from the Barnstable County Department of Health and Environment show that more now than 900 people have tested positive for the coronavirus there, many of them fully vaccinated. Health officials suspect the highly contagious Delta variant is to blame. Now, the cluster has pushed the seaside town into the spotlight, for better for worse, and is providing health officials with kind of first-of-its-kind data on vaccines and an evolving pandemic. Here with more on the cluster and what it means more widely is WBUR health reporter Angus Chen. Angus, welcome back.
Hi, Tiziana. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with Provincetown. It's become a sort of de facto test case here in the U.S. for vaccines and the Delta variant. What are the public health officials learning from the growing cluster there?
A lot. I was learning a lot from this investigation, but there are probably a couple of important takeaways. The first really big one is that it's more important to be fully vaccinated than ever because it's clear that the Delta variant is infecting vaccinated people. But people just aren't getting as sick as they would be if they were unvaccinated. So the vaccine is really helping to keep people healthy and ultimately alive. The other thing that's important is that it's really looking like vaccinated people can get sick and they can get symptomatic from the Delta variant. And it looks like they have just as much virus in them as unvaccinated people who also get sick, again, with the Delta variant. So this suggests that vaccinated people can transmit the virus not only to unvaccinated people, but possibly even other fully vaccinated people as well.
So it all seems to underscore, Angus, that it's as much about what we don't know as what we do know. So, all right, bear with me. What are the known unknowns right now for science, scientists and health officials?
Yeah, there are definitely more questions than answers right now. I think that we've known that the Delta variant is more transmissible than like the Alpha variant or maybe the OG, the original coronavirus. But scientists are really trying to figure out how. So one possibility is that there are mutations in the Delta variant that make it more infectious. Here's Dr. Jacob Lemieux. He's an infectious disease specialist at MGH.
We're quite confident about that, actually. But what are the mutations that confer this property of increased transmissibility? We don't yet fully understand.
Yeah, so these mutations, they might have to do with something like a structural change in the spike protein of the coronavirus that helps it attack human cells or maybe evade the immune protection of the vaccine. We don't really know yet. And it may not even be just that. It could be that in the context of some of the parties that happened on Cape Cod, people were really closely packed together in bars or dance floors, and you're just getting hit with so much virus in those situations that the vaccine protection is just not enough to prevent you from getting sick at all. In the Muse words, it might be like holding an umbrella in a hurricane. You know, you're kind of holding that umbrella, but the rain is hitting you from all sides.
All right.
So these are questions that, you know, scientists are still trying to understand.
Which raises, I mean, that is the lead into the question about masks then, Angus. Those are the CDC updates its mask guidance based on the Provincetown outbreak, recommending indoor masking for those who are vaccinated in high transmission areas. They did that last Monday, just shortly after Provincetown reinstated an indoor mask mandate. Friday, Governor Baker doesn't go as far, recommending indoor mask usage among vaccinated people when they're personally at higher risk for severe COVID or going to be with higher risk individuals. So what is the latest data on masking and how it affects Delta spread?
I think you just gave the latest policy update. I mean, the first thing is really to check with your local health department to see if there is or isn't a mask mandate. If there is one, you know, you should follow it. And if there is no mandate where you live, it's sort of up to you to decide which recommendation you feel the most comfortable with. When it comes to the science, I think that the science is unchanged on masking. And that's pretty clear. Like, you know, masking and distancing can help prevent the spread of the coronavirus. And if you're not comfortable, you know, as a fully vaccinated person being in certain situations without a mask, then just wear a mask. I mean, the CDC and the DPH are asking people to weigh their risks with these recommendations. And they're saying if you're in a place with lots of coronavirus flying around, you know, that one of those high transmission areas, consider wearing a mask, not just for your sake, but for everyone around you. And if you are yourself at a higher risk of complications, you know, again, consider wearing a mask to protect yourself and sort of make yourself feel more comfortable and not take any chances with the coronavirus. You know, I would say, you know, one really important thing with these new guidance is that the game is changing for vaccinated people. So here's MGH's Lemieux again.
The vaccines clearly are not a force field. They're not armor that builds an impenetrable defense against infection. And symptomatic disease is clearly possible. So I think it's a paradigm shift and just forces us to reorient around the new reality in the era of Delta.
Yeah, I think, you know, before we were sort of looking at these recommendations, before we learned these things about Delta and thinking, if you're fully vaccinated, you know, you can be in these indoor dense gatherings and still feel pretty safe. That seems like it might not be true anymore. You know, outdoors, highly ventilated areas, that still seems like it's okay. But you know, we know that these vaccines do keep you healthy out of the hospital. They help to keep you out of the hospital. But for me personally, when I'm thinking about this, it's like, why jump into a risky situation like a crowded bar now that we're lucky enough to have the data that we have now? And I'm fully vaccinated, but I don't want to be sick and achy and forced to quarantine for 2 weeks or, you know, or anything else when I know I could have just been a little bit more careful and follow those recommendations that the CDC is giving now.
All right. So, Angus, I'm going to ask you to sit tight. I will come back to you in a couple of minutes, but I'm going to bring another voice in here. Jagpreet Chathwal is a lead investigator of the COVID-19 simulator, which models the potential future of coronavirus infection and death based on behavior changes. He's also a senior scientist at the Mass General Institute for Technology Assessment and an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. Professor Chathwal, I think you like to be called Jag. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Jack, thanks for being here. So I actually kind of want to start with the, you have a catbird seat I'll never have. Have you ever modeled anything like COVID-19 before? Is it weird or different, or is it just something like you've seen before, only bigger?
Nothing close even. Like, this is changing on a weekly basis. So modeling is complex. What we are learning is changing. We have to update the models. There's so much visibility, so much impact we can see with these models. So again, this is a very unique situation for everyone, any of the modelers who are working on COVID.
So what are you seeing for the next few months for Massachusetts in terms of infections and deaths, and what are you modeling to get those numbers?
Yeah, and that's a very difficult question, especially for Massachusetts, because a lot depends upon what we will be doing in the near future. On one hand, it's possible that we can see continued increase in cases for some time. If we continue with existing patterns and existing behaviors, like as we were hearing earlier, no masks and clubs, restaurants crowded, that will definitely lead to more transmission. However, if we see this as a warning sign and people start behaving differently, if they modify their behavior, more masks, less social distancing, we can bring down the cases and maintain at a lower level, as we had seen for several weeks, several months in the past. The good thing with Massachusetts is that we have a very high vaccination rate. That works in our favor. So even some change in behavior can lead to a lot of good results.
So one of the things that's on my mind a lot, Jag, is the fact that if one is vaccinated, the risks from catching the Delta variant are not the same as if one is unvaccinated. Angus alluded to it, Angus Chen, a couple of minutes ago, you know, lower rates of hospitalization by a lot, lower rates of death significantly. Do we take those kinds of things into account, severity based on vaccination and how that changes what we model? Or is that level of granularity just too much?
Well, absolutely. Those factors go in the models. We see that the cases will rise in Massachusetts, but the number of deaths, we don't expect them to rise as they had been in the past because of the vaccination. So people would be getting infected, but majority of those infections now would be in a mild setting.
So then that raises another question, which is the unknowns. I mean, obviously, you can't model the world and all possible outcomes. How are you thinking about the concern of additional variants. I know that one of the things we hear from public health specialists is we want to reduce transmission even among the vaccinated of the Delta variant because it could lead to other variants that might be much worse. Are you modeling for that? And what are headlines that everyday people ought to know?
Yeah, not at this stage. We are still figuring out how to model Delta. We are not looking at what's going to come in the future. We don't know that.
What makes it hard?
The unknowns, what the transmission will be, the behavior, that's going to be another factor, how people will be reacting to a given situation. We and that changes every time we see cases either going down or going up. So modeling that behavior is challenging. And a lot depends upon these behavior. Vaccination, we can predict to some extent what is the vaccination rate, how many people we expect will be getting vaccinated in the next 1 month. So that is relatively easy. The difficulty when it comes to mass, these like people going to restaurants, crowded places, large gatherings, these are difficult behavioral factors that we cannot predict in advance.
Based on your modeling, should we have a new indoor mask mandate in the Commonwealth?
Well, absolutely. It will help in any case. It's we know that masks reduce transmission, masks save lives. It's that simple. So, and coming into that confusion of if this is hotspot or not, it's not a hotspot, I think we should keep it simple. Until we are done, at least for the time being, we should all keep wearing masks. So that gives a very clear message to the community. That's important.
And that is Professor Jagpreet Chatwal. He's a lead investigator of the COVID-19 simulator, which models the potential future of coronavirus infection and death based on behavior changers. He's also a senior scientist at the Mass General Institute for Technology Assessment and an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. Thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So still with us, WBUR health reporter Angus Chen. And Angus, the message there was pretty clear. Keep it simple. Have everybody mask up. What are your reactions to that?
I think that's not a bad idea. I mean, it's clear that masking is something that we've all been able to do in the past. It's something that is an easy, immediate intervention that can save lives right away. But I think it's also tough. I mean, like, we just went through a year and a half or more of this extremely difficult pandemic, you know, just starting to feel like things are getting better and now getting this sort of whiplash and sort of maybe feeling like we might have to go back to some of those restrictions that we had in the beginning of the pandemic. And I completely understand that's not going to be easy. That's like going to be tough for people. It's going to be demoralizing maybe, but I think that, you know, following the science, following the evidence, and doing, you know, some of these simple things that can be done to improve public health and save lives is an important thing to do. And right now, you know, it's kind of up to local health departments to choose whether or not you're going to put a mandate in. But we also, as individuals, can make that choice ourselves. So just put that mask on, even if there is no mandate, and say, if I'm indoors, I'm going to be around other people, you know, I can take this individual responsibility to prevent the spread of coronavirus.
All right. That is WBUR health reporter Angus Chen. Angus, I appreciate the time. Thanks.
Thank you.
Over the weekend, the national eviction moratorium expired, despite warnings from housing advocates that it could result in millions of evictions across the country. So here is what happened. The moratorium was extended a number of times during the pandemic, but it ultimately expired after the Supreme Court left it in place through July 31st. But Justice Brett Kavanaugh, in that ruling, wrote in a concurring opinion that the reason he voted not to end the moratorium sooner, when it was challenged, was to allow additional time for the distribution of rental relief funds. Now, the Biden administration's interpretation of the court's ruling is that only Congress can act now to extend it. And he is calling on states to step in. Here is Jean Sperling, senior advisor to the President of the United States, speaking at the White House just moments ago.
Given the rising urgency of the spread of the Delta variant, the president has asked all of us, including the CDC, to do everything in our power to look for every potential legal authority we can have to prevent evictions. To date, the CDC director and her team have been unable to find legal authority.
So that's the Biden administration's read of the Supreme Court ruling. What about Speaker Nancy Pelosi? Republicans stand in the way and the administration could act to extend it on its own, is her take. Quote, it is unfathomable that we could not act to prevent people from being evicted, end quote, she said in a statement today. Quote, action is needed and it must come from the administration. End quote. So here we are. It's Monday afternoon. The moratorium's expired, despite efforts of Congresswoman Cori Bush, who once lived in her car, along with Ilhan Omar and Massachusetts' own Ayanna Pressley. The three congresswomen slept overnight on the steps of the U.S. Capitol on Friday night, calling for Congress to act immediately. It didn't, but they persisted on the steps demanding action. Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley joins us now. Congresswoman, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
So take us to the steps of the Capitol in the middle of the night. That is a very different setting from the House chamber. Was it a time of introspection and quiet, a time of protest and rally? And what were you thinking about with your colleagues in the middle of the night as you were modeling what you were worried people were going to face?
Tiziana, before I take you there, let me just say that since at least January, myself and many of my progressive colleagues have been doing everything in our power, legislatively, in our advocacy, to the White House, to Democratic leadership, to our colleagues, to prevent this disaster from happening. I serve on the Financial Services Committee. We work on housing on that committee. Pre-pandemic, there were 3.7 million eviction filings. And we know because of this pandemic-induced recession that families have been even further destabilized, and that hurt that existed for many, that vulnerability has only been exacerbated. So I think it's important to note that where we arrived Friday evening, sleeping on those steps, was a desperate action taken after many months. And in fact, the last extension, I led the letter on that with some of my progressive colleagues to the White House that did result in that extension. So what did it feel like? It was uncomfortable, but nowhere near as uncomfortable as it is to be unhoused.
So we have...
We did that by choice, but we have 6 to 7 million families, potentially 11 households or people who could be homeless in the midst of a pandemic where we have a variant raging. So we were together in solidarity and in protest, sleeping on those steps, but we did that by choice. There are millions at risk for whom they have no choice. So the American people have run out of options, but those in government and positions of power, we have not.
So this
one
is...
go ahead, Tiziana. I wanted to... I'm sorry, just one more thing I need to say this. They would not allow us to lie down. I just want to say that.
So we did you told, sleep at all?
A little, but we had for about an hour and a half. But because they told us that it is against the law to lie down and to sleep on the steps of the Capitol. And I just want to, you know, paint a picture for folks that if you are experiencing homelessness and you are wearing on you every last thing that you could carry, that you own, and you have been moving for hours and your body is weary and you want to take rest, and then even that is being criminalized, because in this country, we do criminalize poverty. We do criminalize what it means to be homeless, to be unhoused.
Congresswoman, so here's what's playing in my head as I'm listening to you, right? You are laying out a deeply concerning state of affairs. You're laying it out with passion. You've been working on it for months. Now we have this message coming from the same party in Washington that there is a rock and a hard place. So you've got people who are concerned about being evicted. They feel vulnerable now, and they're hearing procedural arguments, it feels like, between the administration and Congress about who can do what. How do you explain that to folks, and how do you break the procedural logjam?
Tiziana, we must exhaust every tool available to us. Again, the American people have run out of options, but government and those in power have not. The White House and the CDC, they should act unilaterally, because that is the quickest way with which to mitigate this hurt. And so far as Justice Kavanaugh, he's not king. And he offered an opinion that is non-binding, not a ruling. And his opinion should not prevent us from acting urgently to protect the public health. So, and if the matter gets tied up in the courts, then we should be ready for that fight. But we have to do everything we can to protect the public health, and the administration should act with urgency. The fact that they gave the announcement that they would not extend the moratorium and gave Congress maybe 36 hours to act is unacceptable. We knew this date was coming. We knew it was approaching. So we have three options on the table. And as a member of Congress, I stand ready to be a partner in that. But the first action should be the White House doing everything, because they can mitigate this hurt more quickly.
So
they can do something right now.
If I'm hearing you correctly, it is almost whether or not it would hold up in court, you would like them to take that step because of the time that it buys in the short term.
And exactly.
So then my second question to you, and this is going to sound like I'm being flip. I'm not. This is a real question. You said they only gave us 36 hours. I know you know that the outside perception of Congress is there is no amount of time where it's possible to get bipartisan agreement on legislation right now. Could Congress get something done on this through the House and Senate? Is that a possible next step? Should the Biden administration take the first step that you're wanting them to take?
Yes, the White House and the CDC should act unilaterally. What Kavanaugh offered was an opinion, a non-binding opinion, not a ruling. If things get tied up in the courts, then we'll be ready for that fight. But again, it would buy us time. Now, we've already appropriated the funds, Tiziana, over $40 billion. We've already appropriated the funds. But states need time to get this money out. Now, if for some reason the White House and the CDC cannot act unilaterally, then the Senate is still in session. They could act. The House could reconvene and then bring to the floor Chairwoman Waters' emergency bill to extend the eviction moratorium. So there are tools available to us. But in terms of the tool that should most immediately be leveraged and gives us our best chance at buying time for states to get these funds out that have already been appropriated through the rental assistance program and buys our families more time.
So just
it's for the White House and the CDC to act, and to act urgently.
So just in the last hour or so, we heard from the Biden administration essentially a third plea, which is states, please step in and at the state level, do what you can do to extend the moratorium while we get this worked out. Do you see potential for a sort of a federal and state partnership here where local states and governors in local states might be able to take action that sidesteps some of the federal questions and gets to some of these practical short-term outcomes that buys time for the $40 billion?
Tiziana, there should always be partnership between the state and what's happening federally. What I'm not going to do is play political hot potato with people's lives and whether or not they remain safely housed. Everyone needs to be exhausting every avenue and leveraging and exacting every tool available to us. I was on an organizing call earlier, and one of the most sobering stats that came out of that was that 80% of those that are behind in their rent live in districts which represent 100% of the case growth. So, you know, at this point, and it never was, I mean, to me, housing is a human right. So this was never a matter of charity or benevolence. But at the very least in this moment, it's an urgent matter of the public health. We already have a homeless problem. And you're talking about potentially contributing to that millions more in the midst of a pandemic, with the Delta variant spiking? Speaker Pelosi said that it was a moral imperative that we extend the eviction moratorium. So the fact that we have not done that is a moral failing. And I can't tell the constituents that are calling my office, who are living in real fear, who are in complete limbo and don't know what the future holds for them, that the reason why I can't give them assurances is because of a procedural legality, outstanding questions or concerns.
So I want to pick up on another thread there for just a minute, Congresswoman. You talked about, you've emphasized that this is in the midst of the pandemic with a spread in the Delta variant. I do want to turn our attention there for a second and ask you, is there congressional action that needs to happen about the Delta variant or other things that you'd like to see the Biden administration doing to, I mean, we're learning fast and we're learning from Massachusetts the extent of the spread of the variant, the extent of its transmissibility, and even among those who are vaccinated. What are you watching and what's your top priority there?
Right. Well, right now, you know, my top priority is getting the eviction moratorium extended. And I do think it was egregious that Governor Baker allowed that to expire in October. And that's why I've been fighting on the federal level to extend those protections. But, you know, Congress did appropriate emergency rental assistance, $40 billion plus. Those funds have been appropriated, and we need to get that money out as soon as possible. That is in the interest of, again, with the Delta variant spiking, how can we possibly talk about having people unhoused? It is a threat to their safety. It is a threat to the public health. And that is exactly why the CDC should be intervening and must act on this.
So do you have access to Dr. Walensky? Is this a conversation that you have or can have with her directly?
Well, I've not spoken with her directly. Perhaps my office has. I know we have been in ongoing and regular communication with the White House and, of course, Democratic leadership. And again, my progressive colleagues, just I'm looking for any avenue here to be exhausted and to continue to apply pressure and to make sure, Tiziana, that people, you know, when I was a freshman in the 116th Congress during orientation, the best advice I received there was, in the process of legislating and governing, it is easy to forget the plot. And the plot is the people. And so, you know, what I'm here to do and why we camped on those steps is to center the people. These are not numbers that we're moving around on paper. This is a threat to people, to humanity, to the public health. And it's unconscionable that we allowed this to happen, because the thing is, Tiziana, eviction is violent. And it is a policy choice. And to be evicted pre-pandemic is inhumane. But to be evicted in the midst of a pandemic is unconscionable. And the thing that makes me sick is that it was 100% avoidable.
That is Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, who represents the Massachusetts 7th District. Congresswoman, thanks for your time.
Thank you. Vaccines are the answer on the variant, by the way.
Thank you.
Get vaccinated.
One of the storylines of this year's Olympics in Tokyo has been the journey of USA gymnast Simone Biles. Biles, widely recognized as the best gymnast in the world, many would say of all time, shocked the world by pulling out of the team competition after just one event. Biles later explained that she was experiencing what in her sport is called the twisties. Now, we're going to talk actually more in depth about what the twisties are in a moment, but the key thing to know right now is that they have to do with the way your mind works as a gymnast rather than, say, a problem with your ankle or your knee. And that has led to an intense public conversation on how we think about mental health, especially for elite athletes. Well, two licensed therapists who are local have a podcast on just that subject. It's called The Grim Drive, referring to that push to be the best always. Jotham Busfield and John Cuna are here with us to unpack both why Biles's decision has sparked such community conversation and what she teaches us for high school athletes, sports culture, and more. John and Jotham, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having us.
I'm glad to be here.
It's great to have you back. And listeners, we want you to join us as well. If you have been following this story a little or a lot, if you have thoughts or comments or questions about her decision to withdraw, what Simone Biles has been going through, what we can learn from it for our lives, our kids, our sports, call us 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Okay, now, I know neither of you are gymnasts, but you're both mental health and sports experts. So can one of you explain to us, first of all, what are the twisties? Because it's important.
Yeah, so, you know, it was a new term for me. I hadn't heard about the twisties, and sort of doing more research and listening to more people talk about it. The term that I'm more familiar with might be called, like, the yips. Hockey players talk about it. Baseball players talk about it. Golfers talk about it. It's sort of the prolonged presence of mental stress and fatigue when you're so heightened and focused on specific activities, and it leaves you susceptible for these types of moments. You can't trust your own mind or your own actions. And Simone spoke about that, of not knowing how she landed, or in her mind doing a different routine than what she was doing on the bar. And for someone like Simone, who I agree is probably the best of all time, doing the skills that she's doing on the beam, on the bars, on the floor, cannot be able to be in sync with what her brain and mind is telling her to do, with what her body is actually doing, leaves her extremely vulnerable for injury, physical injury, broken bones, falling off, those types of things, and leaves her in a really, really vulnerable state.
So, Jotham, before we dive sort of more generally into the conversation, I want to stay with Simone Biles for a minute, and I want to pick up on what John just said, because that seems important, that we have an athlete who is doing things that are so superhuman compared to what other people do, that the risk for superhuman injury is sort of concomitant. Have we captured that sufficiently at this point in our public conversation about the decision that she made to pull out? And if we have, how do we think about the fact that she is, in fact, going to get on a piece of wood that's no wider than my cell phone and go back, you know, doing superhuman feats on it?
That's a great question. In terms of have we grasped to a full extent of the level she's at and what she's doing, I'm not sure that most people do. And I don't know if that's necessarily their fault. I think people are kind of disconnected from the day-to-day life of someone like Simone Biles, or a gymnast, or any athlete that's reached that Mount Rushmore kind of level. I think John and I have talked about her in a past podcast where we consider her at that Mount Rushmore level, like a Michael Jordan, a Serena Williams, Tiger Woods, Tom Brady, maybe Wayne Gretzky. Those are mine. I know it's more than four, but that's who'd be on my Mount Rushmore of athletes. So I think people are, you know, fans are just disconnected from what it really takes in the day-to-day to get to that level. They don't see that she trains 8 hours a day. They don't see that she works with a performance psychologist or with a licensed therapist as well. They don't see her mental fitness habits. So they're definitely disconnected from that in general. With regard to, you know, her coming back, I mean, I think it's hard for us to speculate. I don't know what she's done in between the point of dropping out initially to now. I'm sure she seems like one of the things that really stands out is that she knows herself better than anybody else, and she's probably one of the hardest workers that exists. So if she thinks she's ready, I'm confident that you know, she has done or has seen whatever she needs to see within herself to feel like she's capable of competing and staying safe. I know that I'm happy for her if she wants to do that. I think the Olympics are way more fun to watch when Simone Biles performs. And that being said, her health and the health of all the athletes is always the most important thing. I think she takes that as seriously as that.
John, I want to play a little bit of Simone Biles talking about her decision to withdraw at a press conference after the team finals.
It's been a long week. It's been a long Olympic process. It's been a long year. So just a lot of different variables, and I think we're just a little bit too stressed out, but we should be out here having fun, and sometimes that's not the case.
So I have heard, you know, public reaction, John, of it's the Olympics. You're not supposed to be having fun. You're supposed to be competing for a gold medal. And every time I hear that, I think about the sign on the Little League fence near my house that says, your child is not in the MLB. These coaches are volunteers. This is supposed to be fun. And I wonder, is there something broken in our relationship between competitive sports and fun that we need to restore all the way from the Olympics down to the sandlot?
I am so excited that you're bringing up this topic, because the answer is yes. One of the core principles that I discuss with athletes when we're working through some of the programming that we do, whether it's with teams in general or individuals, is the concept of fun. We talk about like flow state or in the zone. We talk about this sort of heightened level of consciousness that athletes can get into when they are fully focused on what's going on. And fun and enjoyment and joy is a core principle to being able to access that. When there's too much stress, when there's too many things going through your head, when you're not just present, having fun in the moment, when those things are removed and replaced with, I should be doing this, I need to be doing this, oh no, that went wrong. And that's when you can start to invite the twisties or the yips, when you start second guessing yourself, doubt fills in, fear comes in. Joy and fun are the core principles. And I wasn't surprised to see the pushback from people saying, well, you're right, it's the Olympics, it's about business and do this. And I think that is the disconnect, because sports at its base is about fun. Most athletes begin playing because it was fun. They enjoyed what they were doing. And we've seen the transition in the last decade or so of athletics becoming much more business-like. It's not just at the professional level anymore that it's a business. It's trickled all the way down into the high schools. And you could make a very serious argument that it's trickled down even further than that into middle schools and even as kids are starting on. And it's something that really needs to be harped on as important. Because you'll start to see burnout with athletes that they're competing at this business-like level at 12 to 15 years old when they really should just be focusing on joy.
So I want to turn that to listeners and invite you to call in and react. Are we in need of restoring the importance of joy in our competitive sports, whether it's, you know, third grade soccer, high school lacrosse, or all the way up to the Olympics? I really want to hear what you think about that. 1-800-423-8255 is the number. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jotham, we had one caller, Jebra from JP, who, God love her, didn't want to stay on the phone to ask her question because she was afraid she'd miss your answer in the process of hanging up and wanted to hear it. So I'm going to ask for her. She has a concern that there is this expectation that the audience owns the athlete and therefore the athlete owes the audience a performance. And we have heard in a lot of sports this concept of ownership and pushback on the concept of ownership and whether the athlete owes the fan something. How do we think about that?
Yeah, that's a complicated topic. I mean, I think in general, sports in general, I don't know if it goes that far. I would say professional sports are a product, right? We live in a capitalist society. So this is a product that people pay for. They want to be able to consume it. So it's kind of tethered to each other, where if a fan feels like they're not getting what they deserve as a fan, then it can have that impact. I don't think in general, most people, or even the large majority of people, I would say, think of athletes like something that they own. I think fans are just irrational by nature. You know, sports are often a place for them to detach and channel raw emotion. It just is. It's one way for people to channel the stress and emotion in everyday life. So it gets thrown towards sports, gets thrown towards athletes, referees even. You know, so some fans and people are going to tear down anyone because of their own, anyone who's successful because of their own unhappiness or insecurity. But a lot of times it's just, I think it ties into how fans are very irrational when it comes to their behavior.
All right. So I want to pick up some other threads here. I'm going to play a little bit of a conversation that we had with Boston Globe columnist Renee Graham earlier today. Renee has been writing about this. She's going to be with us on Week in Review on Friday. I'm sure we will talk with her more about it then. But she talked with us about how the hypocrisy has been on full display. And this one's been on my mind. She's drawn from the world of tennis and some on-court antics this past weekend from Novak Djokovic during his loss in the bronze medal game. Let's listen.
He had a complete meltdown. Like, he broke rackets, he threw rackets into the stands, and it doesn't really matter that there was nobody there to get hit. The fact was that he was so out of control and upset in that moment that, you know, he kind of lost it on the court. And we know what reactions have been when Serena Williams has, you know, behaved, and not even that badly compared to what Djokovic did, but the same idea that somehow, oh my God, she's having another meltdown and she's just bad for the game. If she can't stand the heat, she should stay out of the kitchen and all of that kind of thing. You know, Djokovic was critical of Simone Biles and essentially said, well, if you can't handle the pressure, then, you know, you're really doing the wrong thing. You don't belong in sports because that's part of the game. And we see how he handled pressure, but somehow he's allowed to do that. And we always know there's this, you know, it's not even like the goalposts move. It's like the goalposts are on wheels. You know, they just keep moving, you know, for certain people, and other people are held to a standard that is unrealistic. Again, if a Black woman had done that, we'd still be reading about it. We'd still be hearing about it. You know, Fox News would never have shut up about it. But Djokovic gets a pass on that in the way that a Black woman and most women in general, frankly, but a Black woman in particular would not. So I do think that there are, you know, there are double standards, there's triple standards for this sort of thing.
So I want to ask you both your reaction. You know, that image of the goalpost being on wheels, I kind of snorted to myself when I first heard it. And she is talking about, you know, this word intersectionality is a big complex one, but the intersection of identity here. Simone Biles is a Black American woman. And that has to be part of the conversation of her experience here. I just want to get your reactions, either of you.
Yeah, I would say that you know, Simone Biles being Black and female absolutely plays a role for a lot of people, whether like they would like to admit it or not. You know, we did an episode on Serena Williams specifically, and the topic was Serena Williams and anger ? And what really came through in that episode was that she was unfairly sort of being linked to the whole emotion of anger. When if you look at you know, her male counterparts, it's just they're given a free pass across the board when they have you know, temper tantrums that are indicative of a 5-year-old. Nothing's really said about them, and so there's absolutely a double standard on criticisms aimed at Serena Williams, aimed at Simone Biles, that are not aimed at their male counterparts. It's very apparent. You know, some people still, whether it's conscious or unconscious, do not want to see female persons of color in positions of power. And it comes through very clearly with athletes like Simone Biles and Serena Williams.
So I want to ask listeners about that triple standard. Is that what you see here? Are the goalposts on wheels, like Boston Globe columnist Renee Graham said? And what to do about it? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So, John, there is a different subject I want to get to, too. But before I do, staying on Simone Biles and the team for just a minute longer, there was a lot of pushback that she let her team down. And then pushback on that pushback, saying that if she knew she was going to score badly, she didn't let her team down because they got a silver because they had people who were able to put forward their best performances. It's not lost on me that Novak Djokovic left and didn't compete in the medal round in mixed doubles and left his partner high and dry, and she didn't have a chance to win a medal elsewhere. What about what you owe to the team? And how to think about, in general, what we owe our teammates when we are in crisis, and frankly, what they owe us.
Yeah, one quick thing about the Novak piece, and I'll definitely touch on the how athletes can rely on a single person, is, you know, the double standard comes, you know, Djokovic is seen as passionate, right? He's passionate when he's yelling and screaming and breaking rackets, and Serena is seen as angry. And I think we're seeing a lot of that similar types of pieces come out now. In terms of, you know, her being able to perform and letting her teammates down, you want your best performers out there. And what you've seen, if there were any other negative side effects of Simone being able to pull out, you wouldn't have seen Soon Lee get gold. You wouldn't have seen Jade get gold. They're responding because they're in the right position, given the right circumstances. And if Simone is not ready to perform, she actually does a detriment to the team, not just to herself, but to everyone. And you want people being able to go out there and feeling confident in their abilities to be able to do so. And so I'm definitely of the camp that you should have the ability to be able to say, I'm not in the space to perform at my best right now. And I'm sure I'll get pushed back from Matt about even making that statement. But I firmly believe that if you are in control of what you are capable of doing, and if you are telling your teammates you're not capable, that needs to be trusted. And comments like, you know, can't handle the pressure, you don't belong in sports, I think is archaic and a little bit misguided in how things like that. And I think that's a lot of the old school approach of what, you know, people used to say in terms of, you know, just deal with it, or it's just anxiety, just push through it. It's different now than it was 10 years ago. And the pressures are much different than they were before.
And just for listeners, you were talking about Suni Lee and Jade Carey, who won the all-around and then the floor exercise golds. All right. So now, I want to give listeners a heads up, because for the next couple of minutes, we're actually going to raise the issue of sexual abuse. And this could be triggering for some of our listeners. And I want them to know that in advance. This is also a story that involves trauma. We've talked on the show about former Team USA Dr. Larry Nassar abusing more than 100 young girls, including Biles, over the years and working with U.S. gymnastics. And she talked about that back in April with NBC's Hoda Kotb. Here is a bit of what she said.
I just feel like everything that happened, I had to come back to the sport to be a voice, to have change happen, because I feel like if there weren't a remaining survivor in the sport, they would have just brushed it to the side. But since I'm still here and I have quite a social media presence and platform, they have to do something. So I feel like coming back, gymnastics just wasn't the only purpose I was supposed to do.
You came back for that other reason. I didn't know that.
I don't think I knew it either, but I feel like gymnastics wasn't the only thing I was supposed to come back for.
So, Jotham, I mean, you are a licensed therapist, and we are talking about somebody who was using her skill in a professional sport, but as a venue to talk about and bring forward, keep front and center, something significantly traumatizing and profound. And I can't believe that that wasn't also incredibly difficult to have that be the context in which you're doing something that is harder than anyone else can do and riskier than anyone else. And I just unpack that for us a little bit.
Yeah, I think it speaks to her mental toughness. I think anyone who questions her mental toughness, you know, at this point, I don't know what to tell people. I mean, to go through what she went through from a trauma perspective, from an athlete on the top of her game, highest level perspective, from a work that needs to go into getting to that level perspective, all those things require such a level of mental toughness. It's really unbelievable. I think in our field, definition of trauma has really come a long way. I think it's ever expanding. I think we're starting to recognize that, you know, trauma and PTSD can come from a lot of different things. It used to be very much a singular definition, you know, a couple decades back, and it's come a long way. And I think trauma-informed care has improved as well. I also think this sort of topic, you know, what she went through and how that ties into what she's going through now, I think it speaks to how mental health still has a stigma, although it's improved. I think this relates to the fact that mental health can be a bit, there's an invisible nature to it. You know, you can't see mental health injuries as easily as physical, and it leads to people on average very much underrating the impact on the person.
So, John, just briefly, the two of you are deeply in touch with local sports culture. You are local podcasters here. What from this is the lesson you think we locally need to learn the most?
I think it's important that we're doing the work that I'm doing with athletes, with everybody. I think, you know, the term that I use is prehab, in terms of like preventative care. We need to be going in, and mental health and physical health have always been seen as these two silos, and it's time that they're unified. And I think that's the push that we've been, you know, Jotham and I have been screaming from rooftops to be able to try to get people to pay attention to that. And it's incredible that we're seeing more and more people. Michael Phelps was on talking about it as well, talking about the importance of this work, and the same amount of resources, the same amount of attention, the same amount of time needs to be going into supporting these kids and these athletes with how to prepare their mind. We train tirelessly in the weight room, lifting and getting muscles ready, and in the pool or in the gymnast facilities or on the track and field. And we do all these different things, and we do not prepare them for the mental stress that's going to go into there. And I think that what we need to be doing is having professionals in the fields doing the direct work, and it needs to happen yesterday.
All right. That is John Cuna and Jotham Busfield, licensed therapists and co-hosts of the Grim Drive podcast, which discusses mental health through the lens of sports. John and Jotham, thank you for spending the time today.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you,
Tiana. All right, folks, that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.